same article.
Is this the same?
Okay, present system.
We're going to begin.
I'm going to mention like a question about the digital goods.
Okay, could you just reference, just flag it for him, so.
Where are we?
I'd see who else.
Yeah, this is nothing.
First, you have to start with that.
Just the articles. Oh, you have not the taxes.
Here.
Hi there.
Regular tax committee. Gary.
Yep.
So I forget where I am. Hey, how you doing?
Carol.
Chris, I'm beginning. Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes will come to order. This is Tuesday, April 16th. We have a quorum. The first item on the agenda is the minutes from Thursday, April 11th. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, Senator Eaton moves approval of the minutes for Thursday, April 11, 2013. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendments are adopted. Members and members of the public, what we're going to be doing this morning is taking up a few amendments that deal only with items that are already in the bill. As well as some technical changes.
Oh, yeah.
So at one point, Senator Dietzick is going to have a correcting amendment or on the tobacco article, and I have a technical amendment and some policy amendments. After we hear the amendments, we will take testimony on the bill or on the committee. The committee report at the end. So at 11 o'clock, we will vote on it, and the procedure will be to have the technical corrections made by the Senate nonpartisan staff, and then the bill will be, and then the report will be introduced as a committee bill on the floor, and then sent to the tax committee for further review and inclusion in the. In the omnibus tax bill. We will hear testimony as far as we can get, and then we will vote on the bill just before 11 o'clock. It will be a roll call. I would encourage those of you who are pleased with the provisions to keep your comments to 30 seconds or less. We don't need long speeches about what you like in the bill. If you don't like something, that's different. But those of you that think it's whatever provision affects you is okay. You can either keep silent or you can speak for 30 seconds or a minute. So without any questions from the members about that procedure, everybody understand? So I would first offer Senator Coonan.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have the 0016 amendment.
Okay, the 0016 amendment is being passed out now.
And we will try and keep these article by article if other members have amendments. And this is dealing with Article 1, and it extends the sunset on the Angel Investment Credit. We had neglected to do that in the draft document, so it extends it for 1 year. And to clarify that, the appropriation in the spreadsheet did extend it for 1 year. We just didn't have the language. So that's what this is doing. The spreadsheet will not reflect that you had will be the to the document you saw on last Thursday when the bill gets to the as introduced and back up to the full tax committee. The spreadsheet will be corrected, but the spreadsheet does not reflect the amendments that are going on today.
Okay, any discussion to the amendment? Okay, all in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I have Mr. Chairman, the next amendment I have is the 003 amendment.
Okay, members, and the 003 amendment is being passed out.
Mr. Chairman, this is a technical amendment, and I would ask Ms. Pollack to explain it. I think it's just a cross-reference, but I would ask Ms. Pollack if there's anything further in it.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, that's correct. This is a cross-reference change to the foreign royalties provision that was inadvertently left out of the article last week.
Okay. Anything further, Senator Rust? Any discussion to the amendment? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, Article 3, the sales tax amendment, I have the 0017 amendment.
Okay, and the 0017 amendment is being passed out. Okay, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have an oral amendment to this amendment, but first I'll just explain what's in it. This amendment is in response. It's in the sales tax article, but it is in response to discussions that I invited people to have with me and members of the committee of the division that started Thursday right after the bill was introduced. In this amendment, we met with representatives of the retail community, and we have added a drop ship language to the section of the bill that deals with remote sellers. We have added a requirement there. We've added severability language, and we've also added a requirement that drop shippers may be exempt from tax if they can show that they sell for retail, and that is a provision in the resale. I'm sorry, if they sell for resale, and that is a provision in the streamlined sales tax agreement principles. We're responsive to discussions to clarify that it is not our intent at this time to pursue expanding the sales tax to cloud computing, and there was dubious language with regard to that, so that language is removed. We also have removed references to personal sports, athletic instruction, and cosmetic surgery. So those provisions, those base broadening provisions, are no longer in the bill. We also clarify that newspapers mean all newspapers and not just, quote, qualified newspapers. That is ones that are authorized to publish notices, et cetera. We made a technical correction, changing a word from apply to applying just to make it fit grammatically in the sentence. And we did not think, upon further reflection, that we needed to, at this point in the amendment, although I think I may change that, to state that auto repair service for sales of autos at wholesale auctions is exempt because of the way in which we define a service for resale is not a retail sale. So those types of sales would be exempt already. I do think, however, that we may, my oral amendment to that is going to be at on page 5, and I'm going to ask Ms. Paula to read the language that I would want to include in the 17 amendment.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 5, line 8, after 11, insert, except for motor vehicles sold at wholesale auction at an auto auction facility.
Okay, did everybody?
Can you repeat that, please? We'll make sure we're on the right.
Mr. Chair and members, page 5, line 8, after the bill.
The bill, not the bill.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So on the amendment, this would be inserted after page 2, line 1. Mr. Chair, so on the amendment, after page 2, line 1, insert, page 5, after line 8, after 11, insert, except for motor vehicles sold at wholesale auction at an auto auction facility.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, that's my 017 amendment.
Okay, Madam Chair, did everybody get the oral amendment? Well, we need to vote on that, I'm assuming.
No, I incorporated it into the 17.
The oral amendment is incorporated. Any further discussion on the 0017 amendment? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. Motion prevails. Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the 0021 amendment. And Mr. Chair, while they're passing this out, I'll just briefly, this is on the tobacco article, and we've continued to have many discussions after it was introduced last week. And so this language tightens the definition of premium cigars and then makes some adjustments based on the tightening of that language. We are also extending, we had in the last amendment, we put a floor tax on products, cigarette products collected. So cigarette products that they had on stock as of the date that the tax will change, we put a floor stock tax on that, and we extended the date for that they have to pay that, because we understand that just because we increase the tax on July 1st, they may not sell the product for some time, and so that gives them a, that helps with their cash flow.
Is there any discussion or further explanation requested of the DTSIC 21 amendment.
I just need to make a correction.
Ms. McQuaid indicates that she needs to make an oral correction.
Okay.
Senator DTSIC, Ms. McQuaid, what needs to be changed?
Madam Chair and members, on the amendment, delete line 12. This is a reference to the previous definition of premium cigars, and we no longer need to modify that since Senator DTSIC has defined premium cigars differently.
So Senator DTSIC incorporates in the 21 amendment to include deleting line 1.12 of the 21 amendment. Is that clear to everyone? Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
The motion opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the A21 amendment, as modified, is adopted. Are there any other amendments before we turn to testimony? This is the time to present them if members have them. Otherwise, we're going to move toward testimony, and as I indicated, we'll get through as much as we can and take a vote when we're finished. Any questions from members? Okay, then we will start with Mr. John Tollefson, Manager of Public Policy, Minnesota High Tech Association. And I think we'll ask people to come up in threes, Shay Mandel and Beth Cadoon. So if the three of you would come forward. Mr. Tollefson, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record. Please make your testimony brief. We have a very long list.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is John Tollefson. I am Manager of Public Policy at the Minnesota High Tech Association. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We at the Minnesota High Tech Association thank the committee for including the angel investor tax credit in the bill, the expansion of the research and development credit, and the affiliate nexus program. On our side of disappointments, however, we'd like to discuss the foreign royalty deduction elimination. This is an important program, as I mentioned before to the committee, to reinvest foreign income based on intellectual property developed here in the United States into Minnesota. So this provision attracts that repatriation of income into Minnesota to develop jobs and facilities here in our state. And removing that would be a step backwards for the high-tech industry in Minnesota. We are concerned with the inclusion of custom computer software in the sales tax provision. We view that as a business-to-business service that was originally included in the governor's proposal under business-to-business service. It was listed by counsel of this committee in the business-to-business service category of the bill originally proposed by the governor. And when you customize computer software for a client, you are, by definition, providing a service to that client. So we are concerned to see the $25 million projected to be raised from that area specifically, and we hope that the committee will remove that from the division report. I would like to comment on data centers. We've had discussions on this before. We do hope that that will be included in the ultimate division report or the committee omnibus bill that includes incentives to attract data center development to the state of Minnesota. And we've discussed this before, so I don't want to go positive or negative on that, but we do hope that that would be included ultimately in the bill to expand that to more data center development to better meet the needs of developers here at the $20 million level over 4 years. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Mr. Tollefson. Mr. Mandel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shay Mandel. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer for Life Science Alley. We're the nation's largest life science organization, nearly 700 organizations that employ more than 250,000 Minnesotans in our organization. And first of all, I'll take my 30 seconds of goodwill to say thank you to the committee for a bill that produces a lot of really good opportunities for our company. Specifically, the increase in the angel investor tax credit continues to give us an opportunity to fund early stage companies. The R&D tax credit increases what we need to be about in our industries, and specifically the net operating loss provisions that we've worked with you on for the last couple of years is really a novel piece of legislation that allows Minnesota to really distinguish itself and take advantage of an industry that everybody else wants and we have, predominantly med tech and biotech. So thank you for your leadership on those issues. We also are opposed to the repeal of the foreign royalty deduction, and I know we've been through this for years. A couple of quick points. As our companies in the medtech and biotech space continue to attempt to bring our therapies to patients around the world, and there are lots of emerging markets where there are opportunities to do that, what's most important is that we get our therapies to patients in other countries, but that we create those technologies here in Minnesota. Foreign royalty deduction allows our companies to get to patients around the world, perform profitably around the world, but most importantly, to bring those dollars to Minnesota to keep our R&D here. So I know it's a provision that is an easy target, especially based on the way that it sounds, but it is a provision that is unique to Minnesota and allows us to really continue to be a successful basis for R&D operations, especially for our larger and emerging companies that are moving across the globe to serve more patients. So with that, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you to Mr. Mandel, or it could have been Mr. Tellefson as well. As you look at these overall corporate changes, if you were to make a best guess prediction, will this have the potential to increase job opportunities in Minnesota and your industries, or does this have the potential to lose job opportunities in Minnesota? So that would either include expansion or expansion outside of Minnesota or shrinking of this area.
Mr. Mandel.
Madam Chair, Senator, repeal of the foreign royalty deduction will cost R&D jobs in Minnesota. This will change the way companies do business. So today, I mean, there's no question that our companies will continue to expand delivering product and services around the globe. That will happen. The question is how that will happen. Today, the foreign royalty deduction, which is really unique to Minnesota, understands that our companies need to operate in a complex tax and regulatory environment around the world, lots of different regulatory and tax environments. And one of the reasons this was put in place several years ago, a couple decades ago, is Minnesota had the foresight to see that we needed our companies to be able to operate effectively from a business perspective, but be incented to create intellectual property and do R&D here. The world keeps getting more complicated, and other countries keep trying to find ways to move R&D operations. This would accelerate that process.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. If Mr. Tellefson, could you answer that as well? Do you have an answer on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, the issue for us is also with the foreign royalty deduction, and that removes a lot of money from the state of Minnesota in terms of reinvestment here. So as companies, as my colleague said, as companies expand abroad, they're earning a lot more of their revenue abroad based on licenses from their intellectual property, which is often developed here. It's not tied to that specific, but it's often developed here. And that's what we're trying to promote at Minnesota High Tech, is bringing those specifically, those high-paying jobs into Minnesota that do the research and development. And R&D expansion does that. So that's definitely a positive. But the negative is very significant on the FRD to sort of lose that, not only the actual revenue, but for the business climate issue, just that this is a place we're trying to improve on the fact that this is a place where you come to do research. And if you want a good workforce, a highly skilled workforce, you come to Minnesota, and we're trying to improve on that. The FRD repeal is really a step backwards.
Mr. Tollison, Mr. Mandel, would you trade the reduction of the rate to 9% for foreign royalties?
Madam Chair, Can you restate that for me, please?
We reduced the rate to 9%. It's almost equivalent to the...
Talking the corporate tax rate?
Yes.
Okay. I would love to look at a spreadsheet to have that negotiation.
It's available. It's available.
I'm sorry?
It's available.
Yeah.
It's over there.
Yeah. Let me just say one thing, because I actually don't want to suggest that that's the perfect appropriate trade, because for our industries, as you know, I mean, we've got a really diverse portfolio. The one thing that I did want to say is in this bill, there are job creators too. So the R&D tax credit extension and increase is a counterbalance to some of this. But our companies are all a little bit different. I mean, one of the things that I would ask you all to think about, rather than trading one for another, is looking at the broadest base to take advantage of the diversity of our corporation. So Minnesota High Tech Association and Life Science Alley partner on many things. We also don't partner on many things because the nature of our businesses and the nature of data centers, computers, software, things that don't go through the FDA process, for example, are very different. So the R&D tax credit increase is a job creator or a job saver, and we're really supportive of that. The NOL bill specifically provides a huge opportunity for early stage biotech companies to grow here. So there is a lot in this bill to like, but I think it's also important for us to talk about the diversity of these provisions. It's not a one-to-one off trade. It doesn't affect the same companies.
You know, we could jettison all these other things and just leave the foreign royalties, and there you have just the companies that benefit from the foreign royalty deduction and hurt the other companies. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the point that you've been talking about, I do have the spreadsheet in front of me, that, and as Senator Ress said, it is over there. It's $189 million for the foreign source royalty repeal. The R&D credit and the rate reduction is $225 million, and you mentioned the NOL transfer, so I won't repeat that. So this as much as we could do is revenue neutral. I mean, the bottom line is kind of rounding and talking about these kind of numbers. So I know it impacts different companies differently, but, you know, many times reform is impacts everybody, and we're trying to do what's good for all businesses in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Koselka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, but the net result on these numbers is from a corporate income tax section, all the credits, all the increases, is in a biennium $43 million more in taxes. And so, you know, I think we make a mistake trying to pick winners and losers. I just wanted to highlight one that we are picking that will be a loser. They said that we will have a likely R&D job loss in Minnesota. Now, we might gain somewhere, but if our overall change is $43 million more in taxes on corporations, I think the likelihood is a job loss for Minnesota, and that is my concern.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gazelk, I know it's hard to get your head around $43 million being rounding error, but you're going to really struggle when you get to the sales tax provision where we have technically what is $145 million rounding error, because if we were to move the rate one-tenth of a point down, we would have gone negative. Being that the state has a deficit this year, we didn't think we should go negative with any of these changes.
Ms. Cadoon. Thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I know you asked us not to thank you. We did want to just say thank you for focusing on tax reform and not just on a revenue-raising bill. However, ultimately, we want to make sure that any changes that occur do help improve our jobs, climate, and economic growth now and into the future. We do have concerns over the tax increases that we're seeing in this bill, as well as we expect to see in the full tax committee. I won't discuss, somebody did have some thank yous on capital equipment exception, you know, going to the upfront exemption. But you just mentioned you want to hear about the concerns. So the concerns that we do have on the bill still are on the corporate tax side, on the sales tax side. Ultimately, it is a net tax increase on corporations of about $45 million is what I had. We do have concerns similar that you heard already regarding the elimination of some important tax provisions, such as the foreign royalty subtraction, the new language on foreign partnership, and we hope we can still tighten that language some as we move forward, the definition of unitary business for nexus purposes as well. We also have concerns over the sales tax base expansions, even though we do appreciate the rate reduction that's occurring as well. This is a net tax increase as well. And we also have concerns because we do see some business-to-business transactions included in this base broadening, such as on the custom software. It appears on the warehouse storage, which we're still trying to figure out if that does impact businesses as well, telecommunications equipment. As we had great debate earlier in the session on business-to-business transactions and why that's not good tax policy due to tax pyramiding, some economic distortions that can occur as well. So we'd hope as we move forward we can maybe limit those business-to-business transactions. We still have some concern regarding the digital goods language. We feel there might be a need for some further tightening on that language as well. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Ms. Cadoon, the digital goods language is straight from Streamline, and we did eliminate what we feel is the, in talking with the digital goods guru in Washington, that removing that language deals with that issue with regard to Streamline. And I would point out just in terms of the impact from the current spreadsheet, Ms. McQuay indicates that the impact is 36.82, which is even going to be less or more of a rounding error. And you should look to the impact on the individual in the individual income tax, because, of course, the angel investment credit is not just offered to C-Corps, but also to pass-throughs as well as individuals. And so that's another $10 million that's a credit to that increases the impact of that. And the angel investment credit, there's $120,000 impact on the railroad provision. And then another $1.4 million impact in the R&D, which when the spreadsheet is modified, when the bill is introduced, will bring that number down to 25.3. So Senator Gazelka can continue to make that argument, but I would suggest that you refrain from using specific numbers at this point, even because that direction is going down in terms of the impact and the interaction that you'll see on the bill as it's introduced. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Reverend Allison Killeen, Reverend Mark Vinga, or Venge, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm sorry, and Ms. Maureen Bausch from the Mall of America. The three of you would come forward. Reverend Killeen.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Allison Killeen. I am the Director of Practical Theology at the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. We represent the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. As people of faith, of course, our shared intent with regard to revenues must be that we protect the interests of the most vulnerable in our state when we go about both building and spending our budgets. Therefore, we support a tax system that is based both on ability to pay and one which provides adequate resources to fund vital services for low-income and vulnerable Minnesotans. So this is why we support overall the provisions outlined in the report in this committee's proposal. For example, we support the corporate tax loopholes, both foreign operating corporation and the foreign royalty subtraction. We also support modernizing the sales tax to include services. So assuming that the income tax credits you propose offset the burden on low-income families, we do cautiously support the move to tax clothing. We appreciate your thinking here with the income tax credits and their refundability, but we do look forward to seeing the projections on the overall incidence on the omnibus bill. In general, we are encouraged by that the report fixes chronic shortfalls the state has faced for over a decade, and we hope the ideas contained here help the eventual omnibus bill move toward greater progressivity and adequate revenue base, allowing us to protect the vulnerable in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Killeen. Reverend, is it Venge or Vinge?
Vinge.
Right. Vinge. Reverend Vinge.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
You could identify yourself, please, for the record.
I'm Mark Vinge, pastor of House of Hope Lutheran Church in New Hope, and also I live in Minnetonka, and I'm part of Isaiah. Our congregation is part of a broad coalition of congregations across the state, and I'm here today not only to represent them, but to be an advocate for those who do not have a team of lobbyists to stand in on their behalf and protect their interests. When Jesus taught that the first shall be last and the last shall be first, he was not talking about some far distant future or the end of time. He was describing what justice looks like and how we get there. He was describing what we need to do. Our tax laws offer the opportunity to bring things into balance so that those with the most pay the most. I still remember struggling to make ends meet as a young father, only to be burdened with higher interest rates and extra fees along the way, at the very time I was trying to raise a family. If we put people at the center, especially those in the greatest need, then we create a path to health and wholeness for all of us. Once again, Minnesota has the opportunity to lead. By bringing equity to our tax laws, we will bring prosperity to our communities and to the people. We have more than enough. And if those who are most fortunate and have all kinds of advantages already are made to pay their fair share, we will do well. So I thank you for your efforts and appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Reverend Benji. We appreciate you being here. Ms. Bausch.
Hello, I'm Maureen Bausch. I'm Executive Vice President of Mall of America. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. When I was here last, I told you about the importance of no sales tax on drawing people to Minnesota. It is the number one reason people come to shop in Minnesota. Research continues to support that. It is our competitive edge over other cities like New York, Chicago, Miami. It's April 16th, it's 30 degrees, and it's supposed to snow tonight. No sales tax gets people here, even under these conditions, believe it or not. It allows us to compete for international tourists. As you know, as you probably all know, the Obama administration has made great strides in marketing the United States for the first time ever in history. And their programs are seeing great results. International tourism is up 12% already. They project in 6 years we'll see 100 million more international visitors to the United States, which provides a $250 billion increase in economic impact for this country. Mall of America gives us a chance to attract those people to this state. Shopping is the number one thing they want to do when they come to the United States, and Mall of America is America's mall in their minds. We are the number one tourism attraction in this state. Tourism provides 1 out of every 9 jobs in this state. Retail provides 1 out of every 5 jobs in this state. We, Mall of America alone, provides billions in economic impact every year. For every dollar spent at Mall of America, $3 to $4 are spent elsewhere in this state. We ask you not to destroy this. We ask you to let us continue to be able to draw people to this state. This sales tax on apparel, on clothing, will not only hurt us, it will hurt the tourism industry, which is a $12 billion industry to this state. Jobs will be lost. The vulnerable will be hurt because lots of those jobs are entry-level jobs. We care about this state. We bring new business to this state every year. Today, there are 200 businesses operating at Mall of America that would not be here without Mall of America. We lured them to this state, or we helped them get started in a business of their own. Allowing us to continue to grow will help the budget far more than an apparel tax. Andy Kahn is here with me. He is with the group Armland, Damland and Associates, and they specialize in these financial projections. We've taken a look at the impact, and I'd like him to speak a little bit about the financial implications of this long term.
Okay, I'm going to just continue on my list. He can certainly sit there, but meanwhile, if Brent Christensen and Dan Lipschultz would also come forward. And thank you, Reverend Colleen, Reverend Dungy. Mr. Kahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a handout here if it pleases anyone to look at that, but we've gone through, and I can give you the highlights or the details. I'll start with the highlights, and feel free to ask any additional questions, but thank you. This goes through, and it just analyzes the impact that that the proposed sales tax could have on the Mall of America and its direct and the indirect impact that that has on the rest of the tourism industry. We do project growth in the international tourism industry, not just at Mall of America, but statewide. The sales tax on clothes could impact that dramatically. From the study that was commissioned by the Mall of America, anywhere from 25% of domestic tourists, so those outside Minnesota, would not come here to the Mall of America because of a clothing tax, and up to 50% of the international tourists. And I can't underscore enough how much tourism plays at the Mall of America. 34% of the visitors at the mall are from outside the state of Minnesota, but they account for 50% of the sales. And all those people who are coming here are spending money outside of the Mall of America. The biggest fiscal impact, while there is one to the Mall of America, surely, is to those businesses, the hotels, the restaurants, and other tourism businesses that benefit from tourists coming from outside of the state of Minnesota and spending their tax dollars here. Roughly over in the upcoming bienniums, there could be up to a 40% drop in the state sales tax revenue from instituting a clothing tax. What we projected here is over the next 7 years up through the 2019 biennium, that in terms of sales tax revenue to the state of Minnesota, that could be up to almost $1 billion of lost sales tax. And most of that is actually from the lack of tourist spending outside of the Mall of America, but includes the mall itself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Kahn, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm curious about your math on that, because if you're going to have a 40% reduction in sales tax receipts and half of your sales are already taxed, that would mean an 80% reduction in clothing?
No, this analysis includes...
Mr. Kahn, please go through the chair.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, my apologies. This analysis goes through and it looks at both the reduction in sales taxes generated on-site at the Mall of America, but also especially the bulk of the decrease would come from the spending outside of the Mall of America. And as Maureen pointed out, the $3 to $4 spent outside of the Mall of America compared to every dollar spent inside creates that disparity.
Thank you very much, Ms. Balsh and Mr. Kahn. Mr. Christensen,
yep.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And we're a trade association that represents over 70 telephone companies in Minnesota, primarily family-owned and co-ops throughout the state. And I'm here today to ask you not to repeal the central office exemption located in 297A.68, subdivision 35. None of our members build or rebuild telephone networks anymore. The traditional telephone networks are being replaced with broadband networks. The current central office exemption allows our members to deploy more broadband to all parts of Minnesota. If you remember, a few years ago, the state set broadband goals in statute to reach by 2015, and removing this exemption will make those goals even more difficult to meet. So I'm asking you to please reinstate that central office exemption. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Lipschultz?
For the record, my name is Dan Lipschultz with the law firm of Moss & Barnett, and I'm here representing the Competitive Carrier Coalition, and it's a group of a number of competitive telecommunications providers. They're the new smaller companies competing with the large companies like CenturyLink and Comcast. They're the companies that broke through the monopoly barrier about 12 years ago and brought competitive alternatives primarily to small and medium-sized businesses in Minnesota. So we're joining the Minnesota Telecom Alliance in opposing the elimination of that central office exemption. And I'll just sort of speak briefly to sort of what really motivates us and what the issue is for us. A number of our folks are headquartered in other states and operate in multiple states in addition to Minnesota. Collectively, they've invested over a quarter of $1 billion in infrastructure in Minnesota. When they make these choices as to what state they're going to operate in, a key factor is and has been this exemption. And as they make choices, that exemption is a key to providing this sort of investment in infrastructure that has benefited Minnesota consumers. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lipschultz. Mr. Martin, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Martin. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. We're a trade association of cable television companies in Minnesota. I don't want to repeat what the previous speakers have said, but just to underscore a few points with regard to the sales tax exemption on telecommunications equipment. First of all, when this exemption was created, the state recognized that this equipment is really the telecom equivalent of modern manufacturing. The electronic equipment that qualifies for this exemption generates cable and telephone products that are subject to Minnesota sales tax. Secondly, as the other speakers have noted, the exemption is technology neutral. It favors those who invest, whether it's a telephone company, a cell phone company, a competitive carrier, a satellite service, or a cable television company. And then finally, I'd like to underscore the fact that this is truly an incentive. The current exemption is an incentive for companies to deploy and innovate and expand these services in Minnesota. Projects here in Minnesota have to compete with projects in other states within the same company. So the sales tax exemption can be the difference for a company between either getting it built this year here in Minnesota or being delayed for some future consideration. It's our contention that we're getting more bang for the buck here because of that exemption, and we hope you'll consider changing the repeal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We'd invite Mr. Daggett and Ms. Forrester and Mr. Tennyson.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Tennyson?
My name is Robert Tennyson. I represent Reed Elsevier, which is a publishing company that owns a number of companies. I don't have any.
Mr. Tennyson, could you bring the microphone closer? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm calling your attention to page 13, line 15, and I thank the chair for clarifying that that does not apply to legal services such as LexisNexis or Westlaw.
That's correct.
But what else does it apply to? There are a lot of other services that my client provides in the way of information, and so I'm just need some clarification on that. I ask the committee to clarify. I don't know what it covers.
Thank you for that. And I'm going to clarify something. When we take up the bill, because people have said, are we in or are we out? We are reconsidering how we'll present where the base broadening is and where it isn't. And in the full committee, we will specifically state what is part of the base broadening. And if you're not on that list, you're not part of the base broadening. And we thought that was clear in the way in which we were presenting it here, but we keep getting questions. So I just want to let you know we will have a list. It'll be a list of specifically what is included. Again, and if you're not on that list, then or the service or the product or whatever, then that should be a bright line clarification of where the base broadening is going. So thank you for bringing that up.
I did intend
to mention that. Also, when you see, because of the additional items that were in the 17 amendment that were removed, that is going to have an impact on in the bill as introduced on the rate in the bill for the legacy funds. You know, we have those two, the state rate independent of the legacy rate, and so it's not going to end up being revenue neutral. That is our intent, but it doesn't get there with the further exemptions that we had included with the 17 amendment. So please know that it is the intention of the full committee to adjust that rate to ensure that the legacy funds are revenue neutral. Okay, the legacy funds will be revenue neutral to the best of our ability. That will not show up on the spreadsheet of the introduced bill because of the additional exemptions that we've made. But we will meet, Senator Scoy, we will be correcting that so that in the bill as we present it and act on it in the full committee, we will not have a loss to the legacy funds because of the exemptions that we include within the base broadening that originally proposed and the lowering of the rate, the state rate, to 6%. So that correction will be made, even though the spreadsheet on the bill that we introduced from the committee will show a negative impact at this point on the legacy funds. That will be corrected.
Madam Chair.
Is Mr. Daggett and Ms. Forrester here?
Madam Chair.
Just 1 second. If they're not here, oh, if they're here, please come forward. Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm looking to ask a question about the clothing tax, and I don't know when you would entertain that, whether you want to do that after all the testifiers or that we can do that now.
If you have a question, you can ask it.
Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit about the spreadsheet here. The what's being proposed is a first dollar sales tax on clothing and then the income tax credit. I understand that. And I'm looking at the spreadsheet, and I just wanted to ask where, either from the fiscal analyst or the Department of Revenue, where those numbers come from, that the $541 million in 2014 would grow to $603 million in 2016-17 after what the Mall of America said, and then with the credit also growing. I'm wondering where those numbers come from and how reliable they are with what's being generated. So I'm wondering, where's the analysis?
Well, Senator Ortman, as I recall, that is the revenue estimate that was prepared for Senate File 11. And Ms. McQuay can correct me if that is, if the number that's being carried here is different, having adjusted for reducing the rate to 6%. So that is, you know, the interaction there is part of this, as I recall.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, yes, on line 4, the income tax credit was taken from Senate File 11, and I'm looking to the revenue estimate to see the growth that they've incorporated, but the growth on the income tax credit would be the growth in income relative to the income tax growth that is forecasted. And I don't have that in my head what it was at the February forecast, but maybe the Department of Revenue can speak to the forecasted revenues and income. The growth in the clothing and the lines reflected, and the numbers reflected on lines 39 are imposing a tax on clothing at a rate of 5.677%, so not imposing the tax at 6.5. So I just want to state that difference there. The growth in that would be reflected of the growth that is forecasted for sales tax. And revenue can feel free to correct me on that.
Madam Chair, was the fiscal note updated from the point where the original bill had a $200 exemption for
price? It's not the same bill.
Right. And so I'm wondering, is this the information related to a first dollar sales tax? Has it been updated
on Senate? This is coming from Senate File 11. If you recall, I had two sales tax bills. One was a $200, not paying it on anything under than $200, different from the governor's bill. This is Senate File 11, which has income tax credit. Right.
And then the further question is, have we factored in all the other reductions in sales tax revenues as a result of the lost business at the Mall of America and other retailers?
Senator Ortman, as you're well aware, we don't have dynamic scoring on on any item in the tax bill.
Madam Chair, I'm not talking about dynamic scoring.
Senator Ortman, the actual prediction of what revenue is lost or gained because of businesses would not come into that. Senator Skoy, did you have a further comment?
Well, that's not what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, I think the department does calculate elasticity. I know they did for the cigarette tax.
That's true.
Because they had some adjustment, and my expectation would that they did the same on this, but we'd have to bring them forward to clarify their position.
Senator Gazelka.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I wouldn't mind some clarification on that number, the 66 or million or whatever the number is there. Because if I look at the bill, it talks about $30, up to $30 per filer, basically, up to a certain income level. My question related to that is, are we calculating that everybody under those income levels is going to file for it, and that's how we're getting the number? Because I look at this as actually fairly complicated, where a lot of people, I don't think, will take advantage of that.
Senator Gazelka, I think that the same kind of questions arise with people who would only qualify for a renter's refund or the working family credit. And we've had initiatives over the years from the Department of Revenue to do outreach to those folks that otherwise wouldn't qualify for anything else. The credit probably will come to the attention of people because it doesn't even start to phase out until a family of four reaches 200% of poverty, which is around $44,000. It's the same kind of issues with the working family credit and the renter's refund for applying for what is a refundable credit.
So, Madam Chair, do they build in that there is a percentage that doesn't file?
I believe, Senator Gazelka, that the department will ask them whether they calculate this number based on 90% applying or 80% applying or whatever the if there is any slippage. Ms. McQuay, do you have an answer for us?
Madam Chair and Senator Gazelka, on the revenue estimate from Senate File 11, when we first heard the bill, the department did take into account the non-filers, and they assumed because of the credit that they would get, they assumed 20% of the non-filers would then apply. And in addition, they used the five-year average growth in the total number of income tax returns as the growth in the for the credit. And then I would also like to add the sales tax was reduced by 6% because of the use tax that might not get collected, but they did not mention how they grew it, and I'm just assuming that it's the sales tax growth calculated in the same – the five-year growth calculated.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair. When I've asked about these numbers, it's not to question whether there will be a reduction in clothing purchases as a result and to measure those diminished sales. I understand that would be more of akin to dynamic scoring, and I know that we're looking at elasticity. What I'm asking is, did the department measure the additional lost sales as a result of the fewer visitors to Minnesota? That if the Mall of America now draws 17 million customers from outside of the state of Minnesota, they don't just go to the Mall of America. And when they come to the Mall of America now, they currently pay a sales tax on half of their purchases, so there would be a reduction in those sales. There would be lost sales in some of the accommodating establishments, and there are sales taxes, beverage and other taxes on their purchases. And so I'm wondering if that has been accounted for in either a fiscal note or, excuse me, a revenue note or in the spreadsheet.
Well, Senator Ortman, when we finish, the testifiers will ask the department to come up and respond to that.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Daggett.
Madam Chair, I'm actually John Hausladen, filling in
okay.
for Mr. Daggett.
I knew that.
Hi. He had to attend a family funeral today. I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We have 720-plus members that are motor carriers and allied members. vendors. I'm here to thank you for clarifying that the trucking services are exempt from the sales tax and to urge you to oppose extending the sales tax to motor vehicle repairs. So I'll focus on that. Regarding motor vehicle repairs, most small trucking companies don't have their own repair shops. So they're going to go to a shop and get that work done, and they're going to pay these extra sales taxes, particularly if they're a company that operates exclusively in Minnesota. They're captive in that regard. And the repair and maintenance needs for a truck are constant, as you can imagine, from oil changes to alignments to overhauls. And the needs are large. It's a lot more expensive to do it on a truck than when you do it on a car. Metro repair rates for a heavy diesel truck are $80 to $120 per hour for the work. So if you extend the sales tax as proposed, $150 oil and lube becomes $160, a $360 brake replacement grows to $382. And if you're going to overhaul that engine, it's going to jump from $6,000 to nearly $6,400. That's a big jump. Now, we think that Minnesota repair facilities will lose business as a result of this because we are a mobile industry. Many of our members operate in 48 states. And with freight rates quoted by cents per mile, we truly are an industry that counts its pennies. Now, most of these small businesses have margins of only 2 or 3%, so trust me. A trucking company is trying to figure out where they're going to get the work done, and they can do it in a state other than Minnesota and avoid that sales tax, they will avoid it. And so we do think there'll be a decrease in that. So for all these reasons, I urge you to oppose extending the sales tax to motor vehicle repairs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hauslaughter, and to the testifiers, I know everybody's trying to make their point, but, you know, you currently are paying the sales tax on the parts. So you don't get to multiply the whole cost of the repair, just the labor component.
Mr. Chair.
Sir.
Agreed, Senator.
Okay. Ms. Forrester.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Forrester, and I'm the General Manager of Strategic Warehousing, located in Eagan, Minnesota. I'm also the Vice President of the Minnesota Warehouse Association. I'm here today to testify in opposition to extending the sales tax to warehousing services. A little bit about Strategic Warehousing. We're a very small third-party warehousing and logistics company that was founded in the 1960s. We currently own and lease about 700,000 square feet of storage space in Minnesota and have about 35 employees. As a small business, we pay more than $700,000 in annual property taxes to the state of Minnesota. We are very active in our community and very proud member of the Minnesota Warehouse Association. We understand your desire to lower the tax rate and broaden the tax base to more business services. However, this is no exaggeration. Extending the sales tax to warehouse services would really put our company out of business and would cause harm to the Minnesota warehousing industry in a whole. And I also have a letter up there from Murphy Warehousing stating the fact as well. A little bit about warehousing. We don't own or sell the goods. We just handle the products. We receive the product, we track it, and we ship it according to our customers' requirements. Profit margins in the warehouse industry are extremely tight, anywhere from 1% to 5%. And our industry is only beginning to start seeing some recovery from this last few years, as there was quite a bit of space out there in the marketplace. Many of our companies operate global supply chains, receiving, shipping products all over the world. And we help many Minnesota-based companies be more competitive in that global economy. Our customers' decision to use our warehouse services is very, very extremely price sensitive. The decision where to warehouse products is primarily based on cost, not necessarily geography. Every dollar we save a customer drops immediately to their bottom line, allowing them to reinvest in the company, employees, and products. In fact, our location in Minnesota in warehousing services is away from major freight lanes located in the United States, such as Chicago. I can tell you that this effective 6% tax on warehouse services would drive our industry to the neighboring states and would put our company out of business.
Our customers would simply warehouse their products just across the border in Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, or North Dakota, just to avoid that sales tax. Our company, along with our other competitors in Minnesota that do warehouse services, would really face a competitive disadvantage that we just could not overcome. The impact. To put this in perspective, the impact, this effective 6% on warehouse services would really wipe out our entire profit. We must compete with warehouse providers in the other states and would not be able to fully pass on this tax to our customers. They would just simply leave and go to our other neighboring states. Other states that have passed the sales tax on warehouse services quickly repealed them, including Massachusetts, 2 days after it took effect. Maryland, before it was implemented. Florida, within 6 months. And Michigan, within 2 months. I have a study in 2007 that was conducted by Michigan State University and the Grand Valley State University, estimated a net loss in Michigan state tax revenue from the warehouse industry when they considered a similar tax on warehousing services. The study estimated a dramatic 38% drop in warehouse-related activity, resulting in 7,000 fewer jobs. I would estimate the loss to Minnesota would be similar if the sales tax was extended to warehouse services in Minnesota. In conclusion, Madam Chair, the Senate tax proposal frightens me and frightens a lot of my competitors. We're just so few here in Minnesota. A 6% tax imposed on warehousing services would put us, Strategic Warehousing, out of business. Our customers would simply go to the neighboring states. For these reasons, I urge the committee to oppose a sales tax on warehousing services. I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Forrester. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Forrester, I appreciate you for being candid. I think a lot of the business folks are, you know, they appreciate being here. They want to be part of Minnesota. They don't come out so plainly, but I think you've made it plain that it could cost us as many as 7,000 jobs, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Would like to invite Molly Moloman, Matt Schaefer, Ora Hoax, and Rachel Callahan. I think all four of you can come up, whoever's here. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, please keep your testimony brief.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I am the Director of Public Affairs for Clearway, Minnesota. I also co-chair Raise It for Health. We're a coalition of over 30 health and nonprofit business organizations in the
state.
Would
you please pull the microphone closer to you, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Raise It for Health Coalition, I just want to start out and thank you so much for including a tobacco tax increase in your division report and for closing the loophole on so-called little cigars. As we've talked about in the past, price is king when it comes to stopping youth smoking, and raising the price of tobacco is a proven life-saving provision that will help thousands of Minnesotans quit and will prevent thousands of children from a lifetime of addiction and painful death. It will also save our state millions in health care costs and reduce the burden on employers. So thank you. And I do have a few handouts to share.
Okay. Ms. Callahan, you want to go now?
I'm not done yet.
Oh, you're.
I just wanted to hand those.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
30 seconds is up.
I'm handing out two editorials that were published recently, one nationally in USA Today and one from the Duluth News Tribune. Both are very supportive of tobacco tax increases because of the public health benefit, and just great evidence that you are supported in your efforts. There is one section of the report that is cause for concern, and it's dealing with the taxation of cigars. And I know there was recognition last week that the new definition proposed was very problematic, and I so appreciate the willingness to talk about it, to tighten and improve the definition. And I want everyone to know that we will continue to help and support and serve as a resource as you continue to improve and tighten this definition. That said, I must take a few minutes today to outline our concerns and opposition to this new tax break, because it could create a new loophole in our state tax laws that determine OTP tax rates and undermine our efforts to curb youth smoking. As you consider the regulation of cigars, it's important to understand the intersection with federal law. In 2009, the FDA was granted immediate authority to regulate cigarettes, smokeless tobacco, and roll your own. They were also extended the jurisdiction to all other tobacco products, including cigars. So far, they've announced that they might take action, but they have yet to do anything in this area. So, in the absence of FDA regulation of cigars, cigarette manufacturers, as we know, have manipulated their product to qualify as cigars for taxation purposes and avoid the federal ban on flavored cigarettes. Both of these actions, taxation and the flavoring, make the products more appealing and affordable, especially to kids. Manufacturers of cigarillos, blunts, filtered cigars have also ramped up their efforts to fill this gap. In the handout I presented, take a look at the wide variety of sizes and colors, flavors, and prices that today's cigars come in. Cigars today are no longer the stogies that my grandfather used to smoke. Today's cigar market is dominated not by the large traditional cigars, but by an ever-expanding variety of products in all these shapes, colors, flavors, and filters. It's important to know, too, who is actually smoking these cigars. Across the nation, high school students are about twice as likely as adults to report smoking a cigar, and young adults are even more so as well. Every state, including Minnesota, that reports cigar use data for youth shows a higher cigar smoking rate for high school kids than for adults. Even if you fix the definition of premium cigar to the point that it only captures traditional cigars sold in tobacco shops, now is not the time to give a tax break to a deadly product. A tax cap on an expensive cigar is just a subsidy and an endorsement for wealthier smokers who buy and smoke the most expensive brands. Now, if your intent is to even the playing field and protect Minnesota businesses from internet or interstate competition, then perhaps do it for all products and through tax reform, and don't carve out this exception for premium cigars and a subsidy for affluent smokers.
Ms.
So let
Boylan,
me just leave you.
Ms. Boylan, yeah. Senator Dietzick introduced her amendment to the bill, I think she made it quite clear that she's continuing to work in this area, and I would suggest that you bring your concerns to her directly as she is dealing with the issues. She knows that she said that there are still issues here that she will continue to work on. Senator Dietzick, anything else you want to add to what you said before?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll continue to work with them and others. Thank you.
Senator Skoy?
Well, and Madam Chair, they might not have been here when you did your opening comments, so perhaps you'd want to repeat what you said about the 30 seconds if you're in support and in the bill.
Right. We ask that people in support of the bill, but I know you're raising additional concerns, but with the tobacco article, but Senator Dietzick has indicated that she is continuing to work on that, and I would invite you to meet with her on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Next.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan, and I'm Regional Vice President of Advocacy for the American Heart Association. I'm here to speak in favor of the tobacco tax proposal included in the bill. A tobacco price increase is good public health policy, and the time to act is now. Smoking in Minnesota is a leading cause of preventable death and disease. The legislature took an important step 6 years ago to reduce exposure to secondhand smoke by passing Freedom to Breathe. Research shows that the two most impactful policies to reduce tobacco use are smoke-free air laws, Check, we've done that. And significant increases to the price of tobacco. A price increase of $1.50 per pack is estimated to help almost 26,000 Minnesota adults quit smoking. A recent CDC study shows that we are stagnating in our efforts to reduce tobacco use in Minnesota. Minnesota ranks 11th best among all states for adult smoking, which is a drop for us since 2009 when we were ranked 7th in the nation. We need to stay focused on policies that successfully reduce tobacco use. Your proposal here today to increase the tobacco tax by 94 cents is a critical next step to reducing death and illness caused by tobacco use. I applaud your efforts to save lives and protect young people from a lifetime of nicotine addiction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Callahan. Next.
I am replacing Aura. So, Madam Chair and members of the Tax Committee, my name is Gloria Liliana Casanacli, and I am a leadership fellow working on tobacco control. I want to thank you for including a tobacco tax increase in the recent Senate Tax Reform Division report and for closing the little cigar loophole. As you have heard today, raising the price of tobacco will prevent kids from starting to smoke and help current smokers quit, a smart strategy that I strongly support. While I applaud the tobacco tax increase you have proposed, I most express my concern with the section of the report that proposes tax break for so-called premium cigars. Cigar use is a growing trend, particularly among youth in communities of color. A recent Center for Disease Control study showed that Hispanic middle school students have the highest rates of cigar use. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, our state is not exception to youth cigar use. More than one-fourth of Minnesota high school students have reported trying flavored cigars, cigarillos or little cigars, at some point. Cigars often appeal to kids because they come in candy flavors, like chocolate, vanilla, or strawberry. Research shows that communities of color use flavored tobacco products at a higher rate than our white counterparts. The tobacco industry uses marketing tactics that target kids and manipulates its products to avoid taxation. We cannot allow this to continue. In summary, I strongly support your work to raise the tobacco tax, but I encourage you to remove the tax breaks for so-called premium cigars. We need to close the tax loopholes, like the ones currently provided for little cigars, not create new ones. I hope you will use this session to pass legislation that is both good tax policy and good health policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Tim Flaherty, Bo Berenson, Keith Carlson, Mr. Lynch, and I think also Michael Prethorst, if you'd be making your way forward to. Mr. Flaherty, we'll begin with you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Flaherty. I'm here.
We'll ask you to be brief.
That's hard. My name is Tim Flaherty. I'm representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is 80-plus cities outside the metro area, and they cover many of your cities. Cities as large as Rochester and Duluth, and mid-sized cities like Little Falls, and small cities like Dodge Center and La Crescent. Overall, the Tax Reform Division is a good and strong, bold proposal, and we will be saying much more about this after the full Tax Committee report comes out and giving our opinions. But it is very consistent with a lot of our positions in the past, expanding the base, et cetera. I'm going to talk specifically about two things in the bill that we feel we have to comment on. The first is local government aid, and the local government aid formula and the appropriation. I want to make sure everybody understands. I'm going to answer some criticism before it comes, or that has come already. This is, in our view, a very historic reform. As many of you know, the metro and non-metro cities have fought over the purpose and allocation of local aid for years. In fact, 29 years that I have been doing this. This is a very significant agreement. I know there has been some criticism from some of the greater Minnesota legislators that we gave up too much of a share in this this compromise. And I want to tell you that our cities are strongly behind this compromise. I am more committed to this than almost anything I have lobbied in that 29 years. Our share goes down of the funding. The suburban share goes up. It is a more fair formula. And we will defend it. I wanted to make that point. Now, part of the reform depends on what happens in the future. This is a very strong, good reform of the LGA formula. But really, it gets better. The equity gets better as the appropriations increase. And we believe that a moderate appropriation increase is going to be needed in future years so that the suburbs, who have been shortchanged, treated unfairly, I think, through the cuts and everything that's gone on, because they will make up ground faster than other cities as the appropriation goes up modestly over future years. So that's one thing. The other thing is cities with lower tax bases, many of them in our communities, they get maybe 40, 50, 60% of their budgets from LGA. And if you freeze their amount for 2, 3, 4 years, you can see what kind of a problem that is going to create for them because any increased cost, like gas for their police cars or their snow plows, has to either come in the form of property tax increases or service cuts. So that's why we believe the appropriation needs to increase in future years. The second thing I wanted to talk about just for a minute is the Angel Investment Credit, and I want to thank the committee for putting in the provision for the greater Minnesota businesses. I just want to mention that since Senator Coonan carried the bill to try to make some adjustments so we get private investment in greater Minnesota, we are thrilled that the program works so well in the metro area. And I think all of you, metro and non-metro, would want same kind of private investments in startup companies that the program is getting in the metro area. So we've identified a couple additional barriers to that after talking to businesses, chambers of commerce, economic development authorities in greater Minnesota. And those barriers, I'm going to just mention three very quickly. One is the fact that you have to be a high-tech company with proprietary interests, which isn't exactly the base of our startup businesses in greater Minnesota. The other is, one of the bankers mentioned this to me when I was visiting, was that it seems that the pool of money is eaten up very quickly and that, you know, we don't have the tremendous, wonderful networks that they have in the metro area where private investment and startup businesses and all this is a great network. We just don't have that in rural Minnesota. We should have it. We're trying to get it. So that's a problem with people not maybe responding quickly enough to apply for this money. And then the last point is the wage requirement, which is $18 for startup companies for the employees. That's above the market in greater Minnesota. It may be the market here, but it's not the market in greater Minnesota, so we would hope that that could be adjusted in the future. But overall, we thank you for your interest in the Angel Investment Credit and for helping it make it more applicable in the greater Minnesota business community. That's the end of my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty. Senator Gozelka?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Flaherty, I do have a couple of questions. One is for clarification. It was my understanding that local government aid was roughly 70% rural, 30% metro, and that this shift makes it about 60% rural and 40% metro. Can you clarify from your perspective if that's true?
Yes. We worked out the exact percentages every which way from Sunday. You know, it's but right now the percentage share under 2013 law, current distribution of the current formula is about 69%, very close to 69%. That would drop under the 2014 agreement in the first year to about 66%. In future years, that would drop, that 68% or 69% would drop down to close around 60, 61%. But again, that's why we think it only does that very gradually over time, and it brings those cities in, primarily some suburban cities, but there are some greater Minnesota cities too that perhaps were not treated as fairly as they should have under the LGA wars of the past. So gradually over time, as the appropriation increases moderately each year, those cities will get more, and the share of greater Minnesota money shifts very gradually to that split that I just mentioned, which is about 60-61%. So I don't have the number in front of me, but I think even under current law, the share in 2014 would have gone down without the reform, and I don't have that number handy. But so we do believe, and I know some legislators and some of a couple of our cities have questioned why we should settle for a lower share, and the reason is we believe there are cities, both metro and non-metro, that have their need has not been adequately addressed, and we need to do that, and we need to reform the program. And we, like I said, we strongly stand behind this.
You know, I'll come back to you. When we had the presentation of the division report with regard to the local government aid formula, we looked at a run that had every column except how the new formula, just hypothetically, would be applied to this year's LGA. And I don't know whether staff has had an opportunity to prepare that, but I think both Senator Ortman and I had asked for that because it really gives us an apples to apples comparison. So if that hasn't been done, I'm going to make another request for that and to make sure it's distributed to members, because I think all those comparisons really do allow us to see the difference between the impact of current law going forward if we did nothing, and then the impact not only of more money, but the actual how the formula the impact of the formula itself, regardless of the level of dollars that are there. So we, I don't know that we have that right at this second, but we do want to make that available to members and to the public.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Gazelka, did you want
to
continue?
To that point, however, I'll just to the point about the spreadsheet.
Sure.
I did ask Mr. Paulson for that spreadsheet. I have seen it. I just asked him just now if he had it to distribute, mm-hmm. and he had not prepared it for distribution, so he just left the room
to go and get it,
because I
All
think
right.
it's very important for this conversation.
I absolutely agree with you, and am glad he has done that, and we'll distribute that when we get it. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Flaherty, I mean, if because to moving from 69% down to 60% is a concern for me for greater Minnesota. I mean, we're the way this reads, giving another $80 million into local government aid, and without that $80 million, would you still be as supportive? In other words, down the road, we don't know what is going to be available for resources, and if that you're saying down the road we're going to need future increases, but what if we actually have less? Would you still have been supportive of this shift?
Mr. Flaherty.
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, we only support the formula with the additional $80 million. It sets us going in the right direction. It corrects a lot of inequities from the past. Yes, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I think to cement this reform in the future, we are going to need to see moderate increases in LGA each year. So I guess the answer is, no, we would not support this formula change without the increased resources.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't have a question. I just want to have to comment. The charge that I think we directed for the cities was to go and devise a new formula and develop consensus among all communities, whether you're a small rural community in northern Minnesota or Rochester or Minneapolis and St. Paul. They got together, and when they came to the division, they were all supportive of this. I understand there's some unrest about, I'll take credit or blame for not including the inflator. I just don't think that we can deal with that at this point with regard to the tails issue. But I think everybody needs to recall that this was a consensus item that came to the division from all size and all geography of communities in Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. Senator Ortman, another question for Mr. Flaherty?
Yes, and a comment, Madam Chair. And to Senator Scoy's point, I know it's very difficult to build that kind of consensus, but I think that the change, taking out the inflator, does change the way the cities would look at this. I'm concerned that it seems that we've lost the heart of the issue of LGA, which is to make sure that every Minnesota city can provide essential services to their residents. And when you shift the formula 70-30 to 60-40, I think that only compounds the problem. And I'm hoping that Mr. Flaherty can address that, because the way I see the formula working is with the new money and the floor that goes with the bill, it would protect the smaller cities from having a cut. But if the pot of money doesn't continue to grow, those smaller cities are going to be negatively impacted. Theirs won't grow as much as a new city that comes into the formula like Bloomington or a bigger city like Minneapolis. They're going to grow faster, and these small cities, like, and I have a couple of them in my district, they won't grow. Their LGA won't grow. And so I'm wondering, are you concerned about that? And why have we lost the real focus of LGA with this new formula if it's not about providing essential services in some of these cities that can't otherwise provide it?
Mr. Flaherty, if you'd be brief, we would like to get on to the...
Okay, sorry, but I would like
testimony.
To answer.
Sure.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I think that the formula, there's two parts of a formula. One is the tax base and adjusting for tax bases, and the other is the need. The need that had been under the current formula, the need factor we're changing in this formula, was not a good need factor. It no longer explained why cities spend differently as it had 13 years ago when you passed it. So it needed to be changed. The truth is, our cities are better protected. If you leave the appropriation flat, for example, the small cities you're worried about, the cities I'm worried about, are better protected under this plan than under the current formula. So that's, I was looking at that. That's a major reason why we support this new plan, is that I think it does preserve those lower tax-based cities and the aid they get better than what the current law is, much better than what the current law is. When you get the runs, you'll see the current law for 2014 and what would have happened with no appropriation increase, and you'll see it's devastating to the same cities we're talking about here. So let's see, what was the, oh, the have we lost the purpose and the focus of LGA, which I think you expressed very well? And the answer to that is no, but I think it is even better, and if we had more time, we could talk more about this, but I think it's stronger, especially since we have, I mean, this wasn't just an agreement of dollars and cents flowing metro, non-metro. This was an agreement over concept and direction, philosophy, and that we've been fighting over, like I said, for 30 years, and now I think we have an agreement that is expressed with the metro and the non-metro about what the purpose and the direction of the program is going to be, and it's very true to its purpose of allowing cities with different tax bases and different needs to provide services, needed services, at a reasonable tax rate. That's where we viewed the purpose. I think that's carried through very well in this formula, or we wouldn't be supporting it.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Ortman. Two quick things. The new run is coming out. I hope that you will look at it because from what I can see, cities like Aiken and McGregor would otherwise lose under this formula without the floor, and I'm concerned about that. So I know that that's being prepared. And then secondly, with all the new cities that are coming into the LGA formula with these changes, how many cities would not be included? So if we have 837 cities, I think it is, how many would get LGA and how many would not? Do you know, or does anyone know?
Wasn't the number that there's like 120-some that currently don't get it, and that would be reduced to 80? In the 80s, I think that was the number that we heard the other day, Senator Ortman.
So the argument would be, Madam Chair, that 80 Minnesota cities can provide essential services to the residents, but the remainder of all of our cities can't do it without state aid? I think that's
Senator Ortman, I'm not commenting on that particular point. I think just the answer to the question of how many more would be getting it to as part of the this consensus that we've gotten from the city interests. Mr. Flaherty?
Madam Chair, and if I could just be brief, Senator Ortman, I think the answer is, and I don't have the numbers right at my hand, but we'll get those for you because we did look at that. The answer really is that more cities that should be getting local aid get local aid. Cities that shouldn't be getting local aid continue not to receive local aid. That is the answer from after we did all the analysis. But I don't have the specific numbers. I know we calculated how many cities and things.
Something like 120 down to 80.
We'll get the exact number. I can't recall it. Right? I think you're right.
It was part of the testimony when we heard Senator Reinert's bill. Mr. Berenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. Very briefly, I want to thank the committee on behalf of AMC for three specific provisions in the bill. Obviously, the sales tax exemption for cities and counties we're extremely supportive of and grateful to the committee for including. We also do, as an organization, support increased tobacco taxes as a public health measure, as well as the efforts to tax purchases from online-only retailers, which we see as a Main Street development issue. I do want to touch just very briefly on the property tax savings report requirement in the bill. This is in Article 6, page 6. We certainly do appreciate the committee's interest in making sure that sales tax exemption results in property tax savings for local governments, for local property taxpayers. I do want to mention a couple technical issues with it, one being that the reporting is essentially done on the state's fiscal calendar and not the local government fiscal calendar, where we'd be sending our first report in the middle of next year, although the first budget we'd set with that sales tax exemption would go from January to
December. Mr.
Berenson,
it would have been helpful if you had talked to me about that over the since last Thursday.
Should. I'm happy to follow up with a conversation separate from the committee, too. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some concerns about essentially this reporting requirement, looking at that cost savings from the sales tax exemption as compared to the property tax levy and some direct correlation, looking for a direct correlation between property tax savings and our savings from that exemption, when, as I'm sure this committee is well aware, county property tax levies are dependent on a wide variety of factors, including other budget areas within the state government. We are the service delivery providers for many functions of the state and can be affected by cost shifts and cost shares in health and human services, public safety, and don't want to necessarily be penalized in this reporting process for some of those
Mr. Berenson, it's $200 million.
I understand.
I think we should be we have a lot of confidence that you can reflect that in your budgeting reduce property taxes by the amount of that sales tax, at least 75% of it statewide.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I also wanted to thank the Chair the division for including the sales tax exemption. I also want to emphasize our appreciation of the base expansions in the proposal that will hopefully reduce the volatility of the state's collections going into the future. It's been a long time objective of our association to reduce the yo-yo in the state's revenue collections and the consequent impacts on local governments, and we believe this bill in its entirety does do that. I also want to mention concerns with the accounting for the sales tax. I would suggest to the committee that practically no local government has the capability of determining what the sales taxes would be on purchases. That expertise just simply does not exist on our staffs currently. What I would suggest in lieu of that, and I apologize that I have not had the opportunity to talk to the chair about this, is that we could identify what the sales tax was that we paid in the last calendar year, 2012, as part of our truth and taxation process in preparation for 2014 levy. And this would be a doable task for us, would hold us accountable for the savings that we would accrue and answerable to our taxpayers for the savings and consequence effects on our levy changes for the upcoming coming year. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We will visit with folks to make sure that the reporting period works. We could have done that today if you had come to see me. We're not going to. Anything else for these gentlemen? Thank you very much. Mr. Lynch, is he here?
Mike Breathorst with this Minnesota Association of Small Cities.
Yes. Mr. Breathorst? Is Mr. Lynch here as well?
Madam Chair, I don't see Commissioner Lynch here. He's the chair of the Carver County Board, and yes. I think he was trying to get here as soon as he convened and then left the board. So he might make it, he might not.
Okay.
I hope that he will.
If he comes, we'll get back to him. But we'll hear now from Mr. Breathorst.
Yes, good morning. My name is Mike Breathorst. I'm the city administrator for the city of Melrose, Minnesota, as well as a brand new board member to the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We represent cities of 5,000 and below. In Minnesota, the question was, is how many small cities are there? There's 855 cities in the state of Minnesota, and of those, 696 are 5,000 and below. So we represent approximately 81% of that population. I'm here today in support of the new definitions, as Mr. Flaherty has said, as well as the league, through a compromise and negotiation. We're in support of that. We're also very much in support of Section 26 relating to the sales tax exemption as well. The thing I really wanted to talk today, just for a minute, more of a conversation than anything, is our community of Melrose, Minnesota. We're a 3,600 population. Our reliance on local government aid is 25%. There's generally a three-legged stool for cities that operate. You have your local government aid, you have your general tax levy, and if you're fortunate enough to have a municipal or franchise fees, you're able to use that three-legged stool. Well, you take away those franchise fees, well, you have a two-legged stool. Now, what I did is before here today, I did a quick little survey in regards to the dependence on local government aid. And populations of 10,000 or greater, this is a non-scientific survey, please note, but we had over 20% average reliance on the local government aid to operate their general funds. Populations of 10,000 and below, they were at 33%, and cities at 5,000 and below were 35%. Now, like I said, that's an average. Those cities of 5,000 and below, of my response, 56% was one of those cities, the reliance on local government aid. Now, back in 2010 and 2008, there was some real significant fluctuations, and even before that. And our city of Melrose, over those years, we saw an over 20% reduction in our assistance that we received from the state. Because of that, we had to make some real tough decisions and tough calls. This past year, our council had to make the tough decision with the fire department, our police department, as well as our ambulance, and we chose to reduce our police force by 20% for our community. That's pretty significant. Now, the other thing that we do because of the budgetary constraints that we have, Madam Chair, is the, you know, we buy used fire trucks. We buy used ambulances, smaller ambulances. And most importantly, we had to reduce our police force. Under this new formula that we have here today, we feel that we can make some significant gainbacks to ensure that we can do that. So we greatly support that. The other impactor, too, as we talked about briefly, is the sales tax exemption. We pay, and our budget is $2.2 million. $175,000 of that goes to sales tax. And so any type of relief like that will be able to allow us to administer our budgets. As we move forward here, if we don't receive these additional allocations or the new formulas that they have, I had to sit down this past budgetary cycle and look at one of my 20-year employees and say, we're probably not going to fund you upon your retirement or even this fiscal year. Fortunately, we were able to refinance some bonds and make some play to allow some more flexibility. So, but all said and done, we are in support of the formulas that we have here. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a great step forward, and we thank you for that. And so, pending your questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Breathorse. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Would like to invite Mr. Ted Johnson, Mr. Jeff Pellegrim, Kip Elliott, and Heather Bronick. Welcome to the committee.
Sure.
Gentlemen and lady.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You can bring a chair up if you want.
Get all of us in one fell swoop.
Sure. If you'd be brief, please.
Sure thing. Madam Chair, my name is Ted Johnson. I'm the Senior Vice President for the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Minnesota Lynx. Appreciate your time this morning. Would like to speak to specifically the provision regarding memorabilia tax and our concern. And I would say from this side of the table, I think you have an audience that is appreciative of the struggle that you all go through. We know it's sports has become more of a public-private enterprise over the years. We understand that you're trying to wrestle with very difficult decisions. You're trying to do cost-benefit analysis, and sometimes there are no easy answers. But we do have a concern, primarily around sort of the fundamental fairness of the provision. We are sympathetic to a sales tax mechanism. We frankly are stand to be the beneficiary of such a mechanism, thanks to the legislature last year with language that allows us to work with the city of Minneapolis, our local partner, to renovate our building. But we do differentiate a sales tax mechanism levied on a building to support a building, or a broad range of entertainment taxes that go to support a broad range of entertainment projects and facilities, versus a specific tax that's targeted at all the professional sports teams for the benefit of one sports team. And I think of the Minnesota Lynx, which is one of our teams, still a fledgling league, the only league for professional women's sports, a league that struggles to secure its financial footing. And I think of that 9-year-old girl that goes to buy that Lynx T-shirt, and I think there's a certain expectation amongst her and her family that they're going to support that struggling franchise, that struggling sort of league. And I don't think that there is an expectation that their proceeds would go to support probably the most successful league in the United States. And so with that, Madam Chair, Senators, appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Pellegrim.
Thank you. I'm Jeff Pellegrim, representing the Minnesota Wild Hockey Club. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the club. It's my pleasure to address the committee today. I'm here to share the Wild's opposition to the proposed sports memorabilia tax. Also, we are in opposition to the suite rental tax, but we'll specifically make my comments to the sports memorabilia tax. Like Ted has said before, we've testified before the different committees, the House and Senate, before, and we've generally supported, and you know, obviously so, professional sports and professional sports involvement in the community. However, to be clear, we're generally opposed to any source of revenue that taxes specifically one set of fans or our fans, and that does not benefit them or the arena that we play in. Not only is the tax on hockey fans to fund a Viking stadium unfair, but there already exists significant imbalances in the funding of stadiums. Like the Wild, the Twins, the Timberwolves, the Lynx, and the Vikings, we all play in publicly owned facilities. The Wild pays for 86% of its facility, while the Twins are around 34%. The proposed Viking Stadium is around 50%, and we see that there's an imbalance there already. In order to avoid the state picking winners and losers among the different facilities, we support a more global approach, and so we oppose the specific tax. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'll take questions if there are.
Mr. Pellegrin, you know, just as when we passed the the electronic poll tabs, there was no language in that provision that directly appropriated the proceeds from that to paying for the state's participation in the support of the Viking Stadium, and there's not here either. Just to make that clear. Wasn't then, and it's not now.
Madam Chairman, I appreciate that clarification. What I'll just say is that it's been characterized in that way, but I appreciate the clarification.
It's not in the bill that way, and it wasn't that way for the e-poll tabs either. Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kip Elliott. I'm the CFO of the Minnesota Twins. Dave St. Peter sends his regrets. He was supposed to be here today, but had a family matter they had to attend to.
And I stand corrected. I guess the e-poll tabs was directed toward payment on the bonds, but the sports memorabilia tax that's proposed here does not do that. So the one did, this doesn't.
Like the Wild and the Timberwolves, the Twins are opposed to both the memorabilia tax and the tax on suites and box seats. A lot of our premises, you know, the Twins have always been about trying to provide affordable family entertainment. We believe this impedes us further to do that. There is a handout that should have just went around that I think is important to refer to.
Mr. Elliott, we have it.
Okay. Yes. And it, to summarize, it demonstrates the sales taxes that have been generated in Target Field for the first 3 years, and there's some comparatives to the Metrodome. But the highlight of that is in Minneapolis and at Target Field, we pay 10.775% already sales tax on our tickets. Most of that goes to the state of Minnesota and to Minneapolis and the entertainment tax. We feel, you know, additional taxes, again, will just burden the fans further, and we reiterate our opposition to the tax. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Senator Ordman.
Questions for any of you, if you can answer the question. We heard the memorabilia tax several years ago when we were talking about funding a Twin Stadium. And in the hearing, I learned that it's not just the memorabilia that's sold at the stadium that gets taxed, but it's even the little league that might use the logos from the major league, and that it went all the way down into our community sports associations, those taxes. And I'm wondering if any of you can answer that question and clarify whether that would be the case with the tax as prepared in this bill.
If it's licensed,
I think that's the...
If it's licensed.
Yeah. Senator Ortman, maybe you'd say again, what's the inclusion is if it is...
If it's licensed,
if
or
it's
logo,
licensed,
they're
yes.
using the logo.
If it's licensed.
In the Little
right.
League or in the community
if
sports associations or even the college brands, I believe, would all be taxed as well, that we're not just talking about a transaction at the stadium or even online if your tax works, but it would be even those organizations that sell the jerseys that the little leaguers and the little community associations sell and wear. That was testimony from the Twin Stadium proposal several years ago, and I'm just trying to figure out if that's still
sure.
the case.
Senator Skoy, do you have a comment
you,
on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that it depends on the licensure. And with regard to college athletics, it's Division I.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman, this
is pretty new. We haven't had a hearing on this yet, and I'm hoping that the chair of the tax committee would give us more information about that, make sure we get that information and analysis from the Department
of
Revenue.
And that certainly is going to be available as
sure.
the bill goes forward. We just wanted to make sure it was on the table with regard to this. It's obviously not a new concept, as you're well aware. Ms. Bronick?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Heather Broniak. I work
Broniak,
at the University.
Excuse me.
That's okay, Broniak. I work at the University of Minnesota in our tax management office. Thank you for the time to share our concerns with the proposed gross receipts tax on sports memorabilia, including collegiate Division I memorabilia. The gentlemen were addressing, the fairness of paying for this stadium with these dollars. And just to preface this, I'll say we don't think it's fair for students to pay for the Viking Stadium. But even if the money doesn't go to that purpose and just goes to the general fund, we have concerns with the provisions. At the University of Minnesota, we want students to show their support for our sports teams and for the university, the greater university, by wearing sweatshirts and T-shirts that have the university logo, by buying keychains and golf balls that have our M on them. And the gross receipts tax would increase the cost of these items significantly. This is a 13% tax on the wholesale to retailer sale transaction. And then in addition to that, these items could be subject to sales tax. Right, currently, the sales tax rate on the Minneapolis campus is 7.775%. So that would apply to things like the keychains or the golf balls. If clothing becomes taxable, then that would be another, under your current plan, 6.9% sales tax on those items. So it would make these items much more difficult for students to purchase. And as I said, we want them to wear these things. We want them to advertise this. And you were talking about whether that would apply to items, all the way down to Little League. Well, in this case, I think this would apply to the university mark on T-shirts that say University of Minnesota Law School, University of Minnesota Med School. It's going to go way beyond sports, Goldie Gopher items. They're all licensed, and we are Division I on our Twin Cities campus. There would be confusion, I think, on campuses such as the Duluth campus, where we have Division I hockey, Division II football. So what would it apply to for Duluth licensed items? And I think you would have the same situation for Mankato State, St. Cloud State, and Bemidji State. Those are the other Division I schools, the only ones that I know of in the state that would be subject to this. So then there's the fairness question as well. Why just these students for Division I sports and all of the related licensed items? Why not the other sport, the other Division II, Division III schools as well that are in Minnesota? I think that the gross receipts tax will push students to make purchases over the internet from sellers who are out of Minnesota, who are buying from a wholesaler who that's not subject to the gross receipts tax. I think that's definitely something we don't want to encourage. So I guess we're respectfully requesting that you take the words or collegiate Division I out of the sports memorabilia definition. If you don't do that, I would ask three things. Number one, that you revisit why it's Division I only and consider whether it should be broader than just Division I. Number two, that you would tighten this definition so that it's not all licensed items. It would just be sports related. And I think that'll be difficult, and it would be difficult to administer as well. But we don't want it to hit things like, our med school and our law school clothing. And then the final thing is the wording on the compensating use tax suggests that if a student had possession for use, they might be subject to the gross receipts tax. And, of course, it's a gross receipts tax, so it should really be clear that it's on the retailer, the seller, who has possession, not on any end customer, end consumer.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Broniak. Gentlemen?
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy, and we're now going to move on to considering the bill. We have had the amendments offered before we went to the before we went to the testimony, and it would be my intent then we now take a vote on the bill, but there were some other people that asked to testify that were not on our list. However, I want to make sure before we call on them that indeed there are no other amendments to be offered before we vote on the bill, since we do have a little bit of extra time.
Madam Chair.
And now Senator Skoy and then Senator Ortman.
To the representative from the U, could you tell me where the license fees go for these articles? Do they go into the athletic budget, or where do they go?
I think they
Ms.
do
Broniak.
Go to the athletics budget. I'm not 100% sure that's on everything.
I'd be curious about that. Senator there Skoy. Have been some questions about some of the usage of that budget.
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to remind the Chair that you had said the Department of Revenue can answer some questions
yes.
about the clothing tax.
But I want to know from members, and I think you may be excused now, was there any member who wanted to offer any additional amendments, although we dealt with the ones from the technical amendments? Anybody going to be doing that? Okay. Department of Revenue, are you here to respond to Senator Ortman? Remind me what the question it was on clothing. Yes.
Madam Chair, yes.
An explanation of the
yep.
How they derive the clothing estimate. We'll get that, and then we'll hear from a couple more people. I think we have time for that to make sure that we vote on the bill before 11 o'clock so that we are
and
time for session.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Ortman.
the spreadsheet that we had requested
right.
also was distributed. It might
yes.
help if Mr. Paulson just kind of walked us briefly
sure.
through
yeah. I think that's a good
what
idea.
The spreadsheet shows and what its
okay,
limitations
so
are,
we'll
too.
We'll hear from Ms. Von Mosch on clothing, and if Mr. Paulson could meanwhile join us at the table here to just explain what the columns are. Ms. Von Mosch on clothing.
Madam Chair, members, Susan Von Mosch at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the Department of Revenue does not do dynamic forecasting. So for the estimate on clothing, which I'm looking at the write-up that we did on January 15th for Senate File 11, we basically use our – we have a consumer consumption tax model that we use for doing the estimate on in terms of how much people, different families, taxpayers spend on clothing. We use that as the foundation for our estimate. And then we increase that by the amount of the general sales tax increase that is included in the February state forecast for the budget.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
My concern is looking at this spreadsheet, Ms. Von Mosch, shows $287 million for, excuse me, $541 million for 2014 and $603 million for 2016 and 17. And I'm wondering if anywhere in this analysis you factored in the additional lost sales as a result of the lost business and traffic in Bloomington or at the Mall of America or other retail establishments across the state, because right now we have that competitive advantage where Minnesota doesn't tax clothing at $1, and the Mall of America has testified that they have a significant number of visitors that wouldn't visit Minnesota. And what I'm wondering about is that the sales tax revenue that is generated not just at the Mall of America on those sales, but the other sales that currently are taxed, and then those other transactions outside of the Mall of America, like at hotels and restaurants and bars or shops, rental cars, airline tickets, all those things. Have you factored in that lost revenue as well?
Madam
Chair.
I think, as I understand it, it's looking at the elasticity of the demand that's based on whether there would be, just like in the tobacco, whether there would be less purchases.
No. What I'm saying is there would be less transactions altogether, that it wouldn't just be clothing transactions. There would be other transactions that would not occur that also would not be taxed.
Well, wouldn't that also have an impact of some people may indeed choose to purchase something because they're not going to be paying 6.875. they're going to be paying only six, wouldn't that?
Dynamic scoring, because you would have fewer buyers. What I'm saying is make this change, you change more than just the transactions for clothing. You change other transactions because you have fewer transactions statewide because you have less associated transactions.
Ms. Von Mosch, do you want to respond at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I would just repeat that the Department of Revenue does not do dynamic scoring in general. We do dynamic scoring for alcohol and cigarette consumption because there are reputable national models and economic studies for those two products that indicate that when there is a change in price, consumption does change. But those, to my knowledge right now, those are the only two items that we do elasticity modeling for. Otherwise, we assume that we do not build into our revenue estimates changes in behavior. Now, this
Madam Chair, if I could, I'm not talking about somebody who's less inclined to buy clothing. That would be dynamic scoring because there would be future less sales in clothing, at least arguably, right? That's dynamic scoring. What I'm saying is I don't think your analysis goes broadly enough to fully factor in all the other lost sales associated with the reduction in clothing sales.
Okay.
Do you disagree?
There's been a response, and I don't know that either Senator Ortman is satisfied or Commissioner Von Mosch.
Madam Chair, I think the analysis is incomplete, and I hope that the Department of Revenue will go back and factor that in and get back to me about whether, if they haven't factored it in, then I think they should acknowledge that because I think it's a very significant, will have a significant impact on our revenues as well as all those other businesses in the state of Minnesota.
And we will have an opportunity to continue the discussion once the division report is introduced. Mr. Paulson.
Actually, Madam Chair, I didn't get my name on this, but this is from Mr. Paulson, but I asked him to distribute it.
Okay, but we're first going to ask him to just briefly take us through this larger run, and then we'll ask him to comment on the single sheet distributed by Senator Skoy. Mr. Paulson, would you just explain what the columns are going across so that we understand what you've done here?
Yes, Madam Chair. When Senator Reinert's bill, Senate File 1491, was presented before the committee, Senator Ortman requested what would the distribution look like, essentially under current law formula, so in other words, $426 million rather than the $506 under the Reinert bill. And then also, essentially, what does it look like if there's no previous year aid, if the previous year aid were zero? So that's what I did in this situation. So it has the certified 13 current law estimate for 2014, and then the hypothetical 2014 LGA current law appropriation, no previous year aid, which means that there's no minimum aid. So essentially what's the need formula, the unmet need under the Reinert bill is distributed in that way.
And so that's the third column in.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Do members have any questions about the spreadsheet that we have now from as requested by Senator Ortman? Senator Gazelka?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's just take Aiken, the very top one there, mm-hmm. Where the hypothetical 2014 is $427,077. Under the legislation proposed, then they would get $732,618? Or what would be the number? Because the bill basically said that they would get wherever they were at.
Madam Paulson.
Chair and Senator Gazelka, this is entirely a hypothetical exercise. The bill that Senator Reiner presented had a completely different number for 2014 under that bill.
All right.
And that's because it's based off from the 2013 certified. They can't be less than that. And the way that that formula works is that you move from your current final aid to your unmet need. And so the only way that you would see this hypothetical is if your previous year's LGA were zero.
How about explaining the single sheet now that Senator Scoy had distributed?
On the spreadsheet?
Sure, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I could go back, Mr. Paulson, the way I read this spreadsheet is if you didn't have the floor that we talked about in the current legislation, so there's no minimum requirement, if you just took the new money and you put it into the current level of money, the $427 million that we are expected to spend under current law, and you spent it under the new formula, distributed it differently, you would get this third column. Is that right, Mr. Paulson?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, that's true to the extent that you look only at the unmet need under Senate File 1491. And so that's taking one piece of that proposal and distributing it with the current law appropriation. Yes, that's how it works out.
All right. And then, Madam Chair, if
yes,
I could,
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Paulson, so under the certified LGA payments, the city of Aiken in 2013 got $732,618. The estimated current law appropriation would be $711,000, although there might be something in there that would say, like we've had in the past, where there's no reduction. We've done that in the past. But then you would compare that. If you took the same $427 million that we distribute in LGA in 1 year, without the $80 million increase and without the floor, the city of Aiken would only get $427,000. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Paulson?
Madam Chair, that's true, as long as it's clear that we're not talking about either the Senate proposal that's before the committee or Senate File 1491. This is isolating the unmet need that's a part
right.
of Senate File
right.
1491.
Madam Chair, we're isolating the formula. How do you work the dollars through the formula and what comes back out the formula before you put in a floor or any other adjustments like that? Is that correct?
Mr. Paulson?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, that's true if you ignore the parts of the formula that are the minimum aid that prevent the aid from going down.
Right, so, and the minimum aid is the floor that we're talking
right,
about.
Yeah, you
right.
have to ignore the floor.
I just want to make sure that I get my terminology correct. We all want to understand this. And so under that scenario, the city of Aiken would get $283,000 less and a 39.9% if you're just using the formula, no floor, no protections in the bill like we've got now. It would be a reduction, and there are other cities that would have reductions as well before you applied that floor.
Mr. Paulson?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, at this funding level with no floors, that's how it would work out.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And just be clear, that is a hypothetical and a scenario that nobody's proposing and nobody's supporting. I listened to the testimony from the cities multiple times. They all said they don't support that. We are not proposing that. It's a hypothetical. You can use it to understand what something okay. might have occurred, but it's not like we're proposing that in any manner. And I would draw your attention to the single sheet that was handed out, which gives the comparison from what current law, current appropriation is to what the proposal is that we have in front of us today. And you can see this changes from Greater Minnesota to metro cities, et cetera, and figure out your percentages from that. And maybe Mr. Paulson, I know you're going to have to vote pretty quick, so I'll shut up.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Ortman.
I just wanted to comment, and I know that once you factor in what we talked about, the floor, this is not the actual result that's
sure.
being proposed. But the point of having the spreadsheet, I think we all acknowledged, was to try and understand the formula changes
and
what would have, right, yeah. and without those floors, and the importance of having the floor.
I mean,
somebody might have offered an amendment to take that out. We now understand what the floor does. I think
right.
this is valuable information, and you'll hear from us again on this. Because I do think that as the years go by, as the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities said, the smaller cities in Greater Minnesota end up being longtime losers here, and the metropolitan cities actually end up being winners. And yes, you always have winners and losers. I'm just concerned about that core function of LGA, which is to help these cities provide essential services. I think the cities in greater Minnesota have a much greater challenge than some of the cities in the seven county metro area.
And I think we'll continue, obviously continue that discussion. But I also want to indicate how much we appreciate the fact that the all the interests in the, that are represented by Minnesota cities were present in the discussion to offer this new formula, which hasn't been changed in over 10 years. So we did have a couple of people who said that they would could take less than 60 seconds, and I'm going to ask two of them to come forward, because then we're going to act on the bill. Mr. Cliff Martin, Ms. Megan Mueller, either one of them here. You were not on the list, but you get 60 seconds. I see we have three people, but we're going to hear from two of you.
We will. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for squeezing us in here at the end. My name is Chris Connery. I work at Take Action Minnesota.
Mr. Connery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're here today to speak in support of the corporate tax loophole closure that's included in the bill, and to add two suggestions. One would be we're supportive of the base expansion part of that, but not supportive of the rate reduction overall. We think there are good reforms that need to happen with the corporate franchise tax, and we think the base expansion gets at that. And the second is we'd urge you to consider including the tax havens provisions, including in Senate file 1237 that was Senator Dibble's bill. And then just a couple of folks that are members of ours that wanted to say what they'd like to see.
Okay, very briefly.
Yeah, my name is Megan Miller. I live and work in the city of St. Paul, and I work in the community centers that provide after-school programs for a lot of very low-income people in St. Paul. Without these services, a lot of the families would be in child care crises, not having anywhere to put their kids when they're trying to work. And so I would love to see the money that we could save through closing some of these loopholes and tax havens go towards some of our city's vital services.
Okay, thank you.
Howdy, I'm Cliff Martin. I'm a senior at Arcadia Charter School from Northfield, Minnesota.
Mr. Martin.
And I believe I'm here representing a lot of my friends, as well as my brother, who has a mild case of autism. And in the public school system, he was able to succeed because of a well-funded special education program and good teachers. And so I would just like to see the tax loopholes closed for corporations and that money invested back in public education. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Is there further discussion? Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, since I believe you are moving to a vote, just wanted to make a couple comments generally about the approach we're taking here. There's been a lot of talk about wanting tax reform and tax simplification. And with respect to simplification, I think that the last 2.5 hours have demonstrated pretty clearly that not only are we not dramatically simplifying things, we may even be adding levels of complication. And, of course, the governor and Democratic leaders have done backflips to try to indicate that they're, quote, taxing the rich as opposed to taxing the, you know, the regular folks like us, the middle class, and so on. So now we have a general sales tax increase or expansion, but this rebate program. And I don't even know how many people that would be eligible for it would even be aware that it exists, let alone knowing how to go about getting it back. Another level of complication, another level of bureaucracy, another level of a form to have to fill out or include something on a form that you're already filling out. We want reform, and in fact, to the chair of the committee, I indicated to her early on, 3 months ago when we started this process, that I believe some reforms are necessary, possibly some expansion of the base and lowering of the rates. Unfortunately, what the Democrats in the legislature have done, and the governor in particular, is they have simply taken tax increases and called it reform. So I want to be clear that, and I don't speak for anyone other than myself, I'm certainly open to tax reform and changing things, and many economists agree that certain kinds of expansion of the base and reducing rates make sense. Unfortunately, what the governor seems to be looking for and the leadership of the legislature is a big tax increase and more government, and then call that reform. I don't think that's what people believe to be reform, and that's unfortunate. Also, I find it interesting that if you, depending on exactly how you do the math in this tax bill, it only accounts for about 20% of the revenue that is going to be necessary in order to meet the targets that have been set by Democratic leadership in the Senate. After you take out the increase in the LGA and factor in the repeal of the health impact fee, this has about a net $400 million impact. Yet the governor and the House, or pardon me, the governor and the Senate, Democratic leadership, have set targets at about $2 billion of tax increases needed to cover the spending hole. So where's the other 1.6 coming from? I assume it'll come in some later provision to, quote, tax the rich. But even by the governor's own numbers, that's only going to cover about $1.1 billion of the necessary $1.6 to fill this hole. And then, of course, we have the leadership in the House of Representatives that wants about $2.4 billion in taxes so that they can increase overall spending by $3.4 billion. And the bottom line is, as the governor learned when he attempted to propose the business-to-business taxes, all of these things end up falling on middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, and poor tax-paying Minnesotans. So, unfortunately, Madam Chair, I'm going to have to say that I would hope members would vote against this. As you know, Senator Rest, we've had some very good conversations about my desire for tax reform. More importantly, I think simplification. Unfortunately, I don't believe that this bill does that. I think in many instances, Senator Rest, you've done the best that you can under circumstances where you're being asked to raise a whole pile of revenue to increase government spending. So I would respectfully suggest that members vote against this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Thompson. And I just in one response, I think the corporate article and the sales tax article for the Senate bill, maybe unlike the bill in the other body, are not intended to provide revenue increases, but are intended to reduce the rates in these areas and in the corporate area to reinvest the dollars in the business community, in the sales tax area, reducing the rate and expanding the base, even if you don't agree on what items or services are included in that. The one revenue raiser, very straightforwardly, is the tobacco tax increase, and we have to include it in that in this particular division report because of the changes which we would consider reform with regard to the little cigars. But I think that's a debate that we'll continue to have, and I appreciate your contributions to it, and also Senator Gazelka's and Senator Ortman's. Senator Ortman, did you want to make a comment, and
Madam
then we're going to vote?
I'll be very brief. No surprise that I'll be voting no. I don't think that if you reduce the sales tax rate to 6%, that's a very meaningful reform. I don't think that that's a meaningful difference to Minnesota families, especially when you turn around, on the other hand, and impose taxes on their clothing and over-the-counter drugs, their auto repair services, their household goods repair and maintenance. That's gonna hurt them more than it's going to help them. And I think that if the governor were to sign this bill, it would turn him into a hypocrite. He said that he would not increase a sales tax or impose new sales taxes on Minnesota families and small business owners when he wouldn't do it on the bigger businesses. And I hope this bill doesn't get to his desk and turn him into that hypocrite, because I think this is bad for business. I think this is bad for small businesses and families that are doing startup businesses in these very areas that will now have to impose taxes. I don't think this is helpful. I don't think it's reform. I don't think it's good policy. It's very complicated, and I hope that we will change direction in the tax committee.
Well, just as a comment, that a lot of the base broadening after we've reduced the rate falls on, you're quite right, some of it falls on individuals, some of it on, a lot of it, as a matter of fact, businesses that we would not probably characterize as small businesses. So I think we tried to look at the items themselves, not necessarily in the base broadening after we've reduced the rate, not necessarily dividing out all the time about who would bear the burden of the base broadening, but also then again the reduction in the rate, and keeping in mind that it is $200 million in reductions of the impact on local government purchases, which gets rid of a distortion in the sales tax. Senator Scoy, do you want to comment, and then I'm going to call on you to make a motion.
And, Madam Chair, you mentioned half of what I wanted to say, which was that we are eliminating that double taxation of the sales tax on local governments and also eliminating sales tax on capital equipment purchases.
Thank you, Senator Scoy, and again, and members, and we will from now on only be meeting in the full committee, so I want to thank everyone this session for your participation, for the great staff that we have, both nonpartisan and partisan. And with that, Senator Scoy moves that the division adopt Articles 1 through 8 as amended, along with an amended spreadsheet, and that the document be corrected if there's any technical things that need to be changed, and then presented for introduction on the Senate floor. Roll call's been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Rest?
Yes.
Senator Dietzick?
Yes.
Senator Eden?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka?
No.
Senator Coonan?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
No.
Senator Scoy?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
No.
There being five yes votes and no, and three no votes, the motion prevails, and the division report is adopted as amendment. Thank you very much, and the division stands adjourned.